Judge and Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Upham. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court, I am Frank Spinner and I represent Christopher Upham on this appeal. And I say Happy New Year to the court. This case is basically up on two issues that have been granted by the court. The first issue has to do with whether or not the error that was found by the lower appellate court became a matter of structural error in terms of the review once the error was found to have occurred, which would have resulted in the fact that no harmless error analysis would have been done. Instead, the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals used a harmless error, constitutional harmless error analysis. And we are contesting the outcome of that ruling. Now, what makes this first issue particularly interesting, at least in my mind, is that when they conducted the harmless error analysis, they found that there was harm, so they set aside the finding of guilty of the greater offense. But nonetheless, they used in applying a harmless error analysis as to whether or not they could affirm a lesser included offense, they concluded that they could affirm that lesser-included offense. The second issue is somewhat related in that it's the appellant's position that the government at trial waived any instruction on a lesser-included offense, and that, in effect, the government should be bound by that waiver at the appellate level, and so, therefore, it was improper for the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals to affirm a finding of guilty of a lesser-included offense where the government affirmatively waived any instruction on the lesser-included offense. In fact, both parties waived it.
Are you conceding that you lose if you apply a Chapman harmless error analysis?
I'm not going to. I don't concede generally anything. So I'm not going to concede that. In fact, I think there was a flawed analysis.
Are you arguing the alternative, or are you really here to push the structural error? I understand. I don't really expect you to concede anything, but there are ways of saying that my emphasis on this rather than that. And are you arguing in equal parts, or are you really arguing structural?
I'm arguing in equal parts. I mean, this really is a fairly unusual situation in which they're applying the harmless error analysis to a lesser included offense. And one of the problems I had with the Coast Guard opinion is that, and this is on page 5 in the appendix, in footnote 2, in addressing the lesser included offense, they say, arguably, the appellant waived this issue by not objecting to trial to that portion of the instructions. And they're talking about the instructions as they relate to the lesser included offense. The problem that I have that, and why I think the reasoning is flawed, whether you look, and obviously this doesn't apply if it's a structural analysis, if the structural defect is resolves the issue. But if you apply a harmless error analysis, there was no instruction on assault consummated by a battery. So to take the instruction and the representations of defense counsel that were addressed with respect to aggravated assault and then use that to say that there's some form of waiver by the appellant, or suggest that there's some form of waiver by the appellant, when that wasn't even what they were discussing, I think was wrong for the court. So I think they, even if you go down the road that they were correct in applying the harmless error analysis, I think for that reason alone, that they were wrong. It's my understanding that appellate courts, if they don't have to deal with constitutional issues, the preference is that they would not address the constitutional issue if they can resolve the case on a non-constitutional issue. And quite frankly, I really think that this case really comes down to waiver. And one of the problems you face with the record as it stands is that there's not a lot of discussion on the record as to why the government is waiving an instruction on the lesser-included defense, but nonetheless they did, and so I can only suggest some of the reasons that they might have done that.
Counsel, before you do that, you're tying the first and second issues together, and I understand that, but just to focus solely on the first issue now, if we focus solely on the first issue, that then is not dependent upon waiver.
Right.
Or the instruction itself. It's a question of whether the court could approve a lesser included offense. What does the Supreme Court's decision in Nieder tell us about that? That is, if Nieder had involved a lesser included offense, wouldn't the Supreme Court's analysis there allow an appellate court to approve a lesser included offense if it met all the tests of Nieder?
I spent some time reading Nieder, and I'm not sure if I'm following your question. Did they? I don't recall them addressing a lesser.
No, it did not. Nieder did not include a lesser. Did not address a lesser included offense. That wasn't an issue. The issue of materiality there went to the charge defense. But applying the logic of Nieder, why wouldn't it also permit approval of a lesser included offense? We're not talking about waiver. We're not talking here about what was instructed. We're saying you're at the appellate court level, and an element is missing. And I'm not talking about this specific case here. As a matter of theory, is there anything in Nieder that prevents a court from the general process of looking to see whether it can approve a lesser included offense? Not getting to the heart of your argument as to this particular case.
No, I think the ultimate question is, did the instruction in Upham rise to the level of a mandatory or conclusive presumption and therefore fall into those line of cases, or was it in the nature of a directed verdict which would put it in the line of cases that have to do with structural error? And it's our position that whether you look at the in terms of the predicate facts, and that seems to be what relates to a conclusive presumption or a mandatory presumption, that the predicate facts in this case were not sufficient with the kind of predicate facts that would put this into that line of cases, the conclusive presumption cases. In terms of what was contested in this case, it really amounts to a directed verdict. It's tantamount to a directed verdict. I mean, it's not a directed verdict, but in terms of what was being contested in this case, it's tantamount to a directed verdict, and that's why we put in the structural error.
In your view, what was left for the members to decide?
Well, obviously,
after that instruction.
Well, after that instruction, I don't think there was anything left for them to decide. I mean, there was no lesser included offense for them to vote on, and I think basically, given that it was clear that my client had sexual intercourse and that he was HIV positive, that basically, if you followed that instruction, you had no choice but to find him guilty of aggravated assault.
There were no factual matters for the members to determine at that point.
That's right. I mean, basically, it's sort of like, why are we here?
During his testimony, just so I make sure exactly what the record said, he appeared to admit that he had unprotected sexual intercourse with this individual without advising her of his HIV status.
There was no issue as to whether or not he had failed to advise her of his HIV status.
But the government still seems to think that they had to prove those elements. That's what they're saying. Those are the predicate facts that they had to prove.
And you have to have facts upon which to base a verdict, but because none of those facts were contested facts, given that the instruction, it was like the defense counsel was saying the trial, what am I supposed to argue here? Because you basically told them they have to find my client guilty. And I guess the question... No, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, am I correct in reading the defense below that the defense was not that he did not do the acts? The defense was that due to his low viral load and the advances in medical science, that this was not activity that was likely to cause death or grievous bodily harm.
Right. And our position was, at least in the one of the issues we presented, was even as a legal sufficiency matter, that was the case.
Okay. Thanks.
So basically, the judge, by his instruction, took this out of the jury's hands. And
but in your view is that the member should have determined that.
Right.
And then you'd argue legal sufficiency.
Right.
But your point is that at least is for the members to determine.
Right. Right, and so what we have here is the trial judge basically took it out of the jury's hands and said the only contested or the real contested issue with respect to this offense, I have decided. And so now you must follow my instruction, and so it's there's no factual issue really for the jury to resolve at that point.
Which is your better argument, the waiver argument or issue
one? Well, I think the waiver argument is a better argument. I mean, we're really splitting hairs here, and I don't have a lot of hairs to split anymore, but when you're starting to say, is this a mandatory presumption or is this a directed verdict, I couldn't find any case that really answered that question. So,
can you find a case that holds that the United States is stopped in a criminal case in the way you argue?
Is it stopped with respect
you're, to... You're arguing basically judicial estoppel.
Well, I mean, that's...
Has the United States ever been stopped in a criminal case?
I don't know that they have.
Okay.
But, again, that's probably more by analogy.
Okay.
And with my tongue on the cheek on that one.
More to the point on the second issue. Can the parties by agreement undercut the statutory duty of a CCA under Article 66 to review the whole record and find it correct in facts and law? Let's assume the parties agreed that they didn't want an instruction on this LIO, and there wasn't an instruction, but the statutory mandate of the CCA is to examine the whole record and determine it's correct in facts and law.
Right, and that is a statutory mandate, and I suppose in one sense, no, they cannot. On the other hand, I think that the trial judge could have overridden both parties, I think, and again, I don't know that I looked at this issue, but I think the judge could have said, I'm not going to accept the waivers of both parties. It's my duty to give an instruction on that IOs.
And wouldn't we be here then assessing that, and the defense would feel very put out that when both parties were agreed to have an oral or non instruction, the judge decide to go ahead and instruct on the lesser included.
I'm sorry. Was there a question?
No, that was a question, and you answered it. Yes, we probably would be here. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
Here's the question in my mind on this particular issue. Is because it's interesting. I mean, if a defense counsel waives it, and then on the appeal they want to re-raise it, you know, it's clear that by waiving it that they cannot raise it on appeal. I think that's where the law has been and what it's addressed. But the government, you don't appeal a government waiver. And so the question in my mind is how do we deal with this government waiver? What does that mean and what discretion does that leave with the appellate court? And that's where I couldn't find it in the law.
Well, if we're talking about waiver, what is it that the government waived? That is, did the government waive an incorrect instruction or did the government waive a correct instruction? And in that regard, if the instruction is incorrect, why is the government then bound on appeal? Or why is the court, to follow on the earlier question, why is the Court of Criminal Appeals bound on appeal if the waiver went to an instruction that was incorrect rather than correct?
Well, I think it's not so much an instruction as it is waiver of presenting that issue to the members.
I understand your answer to that question, but when the government entered its waiver, if there was a waiver, it was all or nothing in the context of an assumption that they were going to have a correctly instructed panel. And now on appeal, the Court of Criminal Appeals is faced with an incorrectly instructed panel.
Well, are we talking about the waiver issue?
Yeah. In other words, if the government waived the issue of lesser included, it was doing it in the context of an assumption that the members would be correctly instructed. Now the government's on appeal before the Court of Criminal Appeals, and they find the Court of Criminal Appeals, or the Court of Criminal Appeals finds itself in a situation where the members were not correctly instructed, so the assumptions upon which any waiver took place no longer pertain.
And there's no basis for withdrawing those inferences from the record, Your Honor. My position is, when you're taking an all-or-nothing approach, it's really more of a tactical approach. It's not, we think they're being instructed correctly on this other issue, so therefore we are now waiving the lesser-included offense. If they said that on the record, then that might be a legitimate basis for looking at this issue, but they didn't. I see this as a...
So the government's required to say on the record, we want all or nothing, assuming you get it right, Judge, but we're preserving the option for a Court of Criminal Appeals to approve the lesser if you get it wrong?
They can say whatever they want.
Okay.
I see it as a blanket waiver. And quite frankly, given the other specification and charge in this case to which my client pled guilty, the way I view it is that they wanted an aggravated assault conviction, or they didn't need a lesser-included offense conviction because they already had the conviction under Article 133, which was almost, and in fact was found to be multiplicious. So I see that...
I don't believe that's the record. My understanding of the record is the judge said he would treat them as multiplicious for sentencing, a concept which this court has distinguished from legal multiplicity.
Right. No, I, that's not what I meant, Your Honor. I apologize. What I'm saying is that it was a prosecutorial discretion kind of waiver. In other words, he has pled guilty to this other charge and specification, which is almost the same as an assault consummated by a battery. And so given the way the case was charged, they really wanted the aggravated assault conviction. And so as a matter of prosecutorial discretion and tactics, they saw no need to get a conviction for assault consummated by a battery. And it was only in that sense that I met, and ultimately, even with the conviction for assault consummated by a battery, the judge treated it as multiplicious for sentencing. I didn't mean to say anything more than that. So,
Counsel, with respect to remedy, you've requested a sentence rehearing. Now, assuming that you're correct as a matter of law on either or both points, would it also be an appropriate remedy for the court to say, our court to say to the lower court, well, you set aside the findings in the as to the greater offense, and if we agree with you that it was error to then instate a lesser included offense, wouldn't it be appropriate then to have a rehearing on findings as well?
I'll admit I didn't think of they. You can't authorize a rehearing.
And if there's a rehearing on findings as well,
right,
then wouldn't your client be exposed to a full sentence of 9 months confinement at that point? The Court of Criminal Appeals did 4 months, but if you have a rehearing on, he could be convicted of the underlying offense and then be sentenced to 9 months confinement, so he'd have to serve more confinement than he's served at this point. Under Article 63.
The maximum that could be approved, I think, would only be 9 months.
Right. The Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed only 4 months, is that correct?
Right. Right. I follow you. I agree with the analysis. And at this point, I only have 1 minute left. I really have nothing further to argue other than so I'm prepared to release the rest of my 53.21 seconds now.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel. You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal if you feel that you need it. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Ron Celia Coast Guard on behalf of Pelley, United States. Unless Your Honors want me to go a different way, I'm going to go from the first issue to the second issue here this morning. And I ask first, with regard to the first issue, that you affirm the Coast Guard Court's use of a harmless error analysis and application of a harmless error analysis to this case, to the instructional error in this case, and that their actual determination that the error was harmless with regard to the lesser included offense of assault contemplated by battery was also correct. I think it's important to begin the analysis with this case with the applicable statutory requirement for evaluation of error, Article 59A. And it says a finding or sentence of a court-martial may not be held incorrect on the ground of error law unless the error materially prejudices the substantial rights of the accused. Now, we look at what's the purpose of 59A, just like in the rules of federal criminal procedure of their harmless error statute. The purpose is it's a recognition that errors happen during the dynamic atmosphere of a trial process. And when errors happen, it doesn't necessarily require this court or any other reviewing authority to set aside the whole entire findings of the case. They can still be affirmed despite an error if that error doesn't rise to a level that requires reversal.
What facts did the government need to establish? What facts were contested at trial that were predicate facts under this theory?
Well, Your Honor, the government had to prove all facts beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the defense didn't...
Well, he admitted that he had unprotected sex and that he didn't inform her. So what else was necessary under the instruction for a conviction?
Under the instruction, those were the predicate facts, Your Honor.
Okay, and they were admitted.
Yes, the defense did not oppose those, Your Honor, but they were still required, and the instruction was given to the members that they had to find those facts beyond a reasonable doubt. And similarly to, in a guilty plea, in a provency plea, they still have to find those facts beyond a reasonable doubt.
But the defendant testified to all of that. I mean, he didn't contest that.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay.
And it's interesting to note, while this court hasn't adopted a rule of a presumption that a harmless error analysis can apply, the Supreme Court has adopted a presumption rule where they said where a defendant is represented by counsel and there's an impartial adjudicator at trial, they start with the presumption that a harmless error analysis can't apply in the case.
Counsel, am I correct that Captain B, the woman with whom appellant had unprotected sex, was called to testify on the merits of the court-martial?
Yes, ma'am.
And she gave testimony that there had been that she'd had sex and she didn't know he had HIV and that it was unprotected?
That's correct, ma'am. And in fact, it's only been recognized in limited circumstances that errors rise to structural errors. Structural error, those errors that are so fundamental to the process that the court martial or trial cannot be deemed to have served its purpose. Some of these examples where it's been held to be a structural error would be, for instance, exclusion of members based on race, denial of the right to an open public trial, denial of counsel, denial of an impartial judge or adjudicator. Another, I think, which is pretty relevant to this case, but is distinguishable, is erroneous instruction on what constitutes reasonable doubt. In that case, the standard of reasonable doubt is a constitutional protection. Also, an error in that case would be a structural error. So the question the court should ask itself,
but constitutional doesn't necessarily equal structural, right? Just because it's constitutional doesn't mean it's structural.
No, that's correct. Okay. It's clear that the constitutional errors can occur and still be amenable to a harmless error.
Right.
So whether or not this is a structural error, the question is, did this instruction deprive the appellant of the base protection without his trial could reasonably or sufficiently be used as a mechanism for determining his guilt or innocence?
Counsel, as I understand the structure and the structural element argument that the defense is making, it's that the structure requires that the essential facts be found by a panel, a jury, a civilian life court-martial panel in the military, and that in this case, the instruction that was given deprived the accused of the opportunity to have that structural decision made by the panel. That is, that the argument here that there was something particular about the unprotected sex that raised it from the regulatory violation to which he pled guilty into the assault was a matter that the members had no decision to make because of the instruction. And therefore, he was deprived of the structure, that is, a panel decision on the essential element that distinguished this offense from the offense to which he pled guilty.
So I'm sorry, I'm not...
So my question is, how do you respond to that? That is, did the panel members have to find anything different with respect to this charged offense from that which they found, which they did, to which he pled guilty with respect to the regulatory offense?
So you're talking about the Article 133?
Yeah.
Oh, well, the additional element they have to find there, I believe, was that what's required when there's conduct unbecoming. So there's that additional element. But in this case, the additional element would have been that means like death or grievous bodily harm and an offensive touching. So those weren't necessarily elements of the other offense.
Right. And in those offenses, what's your argument in response to the defense proposition that there was nothing that the members had to find with respect to those elements because the judge instructed that the unprotected sex was sufficient to convict him for that offense?
Well, we did concede to the lower court that those were errors. The judge's instructions were errors with regard to those two elements. But they still had to find, the members had to find beyond a reasonable doubt of the underlying predicate facts. And it's clear the case law says that even when there's an element that is wrong, whether there's been an erroneous instruction on a single element, where the predicate facts still need to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, then you can still find the person guilty.
Counsel, does the fact that appellant may have made admissions at trial with respect to certain aspects or elements of the underlying offense relieve the government from having to prove them or relieve the military judge from having to instruct the members that they need to find those facts beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, no, Your Honor. I don't think it does. I think the government, just as it is in Providency, just because an accused admits it, this still needs to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And I believe the instructions with regard to that element, those elements, they had to find that the appellant in this case had unprotected, uninformed intercourse while HIV positive. They had to find that beyond a reasonable doubt. Those are the underlying predicate facts that they had to find. And just with regard to this issue of whether or not a harmless error analysis applies, I mean, we've seen it before. An example would be, and I think obviously, you touched on it before, that Nader, and I think Nader is really a controlling case here to look at whether or not a harmless error analysis can apply, even where an essential element of the criminality has been either removed or erroneously instructed to the members.
In Nader, was there anything at trial in which the materiality issue was contested?
No, Your Honor. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we've got a situation in Nader in which the element that was taken away from the members was not a contested matter at trial. Following Nader, is there any case that you could point to, either in the Article III courts or in our court,
in which a matter that was a contested matter at trial was taken away from the members, and it was considered to be a subject to a harmless error analysis rather than a structural analysis.
Well, Your Honor, what I can point to is Brewer for in the case of military cases. The instruction there told the members that if you absent evidence to the contrary, you can presume wrongfulness of use, and that was definitely a contested matter whether or not the use of controlled substance in a 112 alpha case was wrongful. And in that case, although there isn't a discussion of when the harmless error analysis applies in the constitutional harmless beyond reasonable doubt analysis applies, they did, in fact, or the court, this court did, in fact, apply harmless error beyond reasonable doubt analysis. And interesting, in that case, they, similar to this one, they set aside. They found that it was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But nonetheless, they used that test. And because, and just to conclude on this issue, because the court, unless there's more questions, but because this court also reviews the Coast Guard's determination of harmless beyond a reasonable doubt de novo, we also ask that the test that the Coast Guard court used was proper, whether a rational jury or court martial members would have found guilty absent error. And I would ask the court to affirm the Coast Guard court's issue. Now we move on to waiver. Again, I think it's important to start with the rules. And RCM 920E2 instructs that a military judge must give an instruction on a lesser-included offense in all cases. Obviously, this court has established case law that says that instruction on a lesser-included offense can be affirmatively waived by the defense. And it's just looking more at this, who has the right to waive? Who has the right to waiver? It's the defendant. And the government is an argument, of course, we stated at trial that we waived instruction on lesser-included offense. But the statutory or the case law holding who has the right to a waiver is the accused. And we look at what was waived in this case. In this case, the waiver was on an instruction of a lesser-included offense. And so what is the effect of that waiver? The effect is that you cannot then argue on appeal that failure to give that instruction was error. And I would ask the court to hold that that is the narrow definition of what the effect of a waiver is. You cannot then argue on appeal failure to give that instruction was error. Otherwise, I think the court touched on it earlier during appellant's argument, is that any reviewing authority would then be precluded from setting aside a greater offense and finding an appellant guilty of only so much of the offense as includes a lesser included offense. The statute is clear. 59B is clear. Any reviewing authority can approve or affirm instead so much of the finding as includes a lesser included offense. And of course, to say otherwise, I think so. We could have a possibility where there would be a case where an instruction is waived by an appellant or by the accused at trial, and then the convening authority then cannot take, as a matter of discretionary clemency, cannot set aside a greater finding and find guilty of a lesser included offense. I think that's what happens if you follow the argument to its conclusion, that a waiver at trial then precludes a whole from the government from ever saying that they can be found guilty of a lesser included offense. A waiver is just not inconsistent with these statutory authorities. So I'd ask that the court hold in this case that waiver does not limit the authority of the CCA or any other reviewing authority to find the lesser included offense, nor does it prohibit the government from arguing in the alternative to finding, to argue either to this court or to the lower court, in the alternative to finding that an appellant is guilty to a greater offense.
Can I just make sure I'm understanding your argument on waiver? Is this the distinction between them saying my specific objection is with respect to that sentence versus objection to the whole paragraph? Or what specifically did they waive and where?
When there's a waiver, Your Honor, when you waive an instruction on a lesser included offense on appeal, you cannot
argue. I understand that. Where in the record do they just the specific words used?
The Coast Guard Court, in the opinion, puts the whole entire instructions to the members, and you find that on 3 and 4 of the joint appendix. And the instructions in question are italicized on page 4 of the joint appendix in the Coast Guard Court's opinion. Is there? Okay. So just in conclusion on this issue is that waiver does not limit the authority of any reviewing authority to find a lesser included offense, nor does it prohibit the government from arguing. I would ask that you hold that. It does not prohibit the government from arguing to some reviewing authority that they can then find an appellant guilty of a lesser included offense.
Counsel, if we were to conclude, and I'm not suggesting we will or that asking you to concede, but if we were to conclude that the lower court erred either in terms of finding the error harmless or in applying a harmless standard, either one, would it be within our authority at that point, this is the same question I asked the defense counsel, to authorize a rehearing on findings, and if so, would the maximum sentence on findings be 9 months confinement rather than the 4 months approved by the CCA?
I would agree that would be the case, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then...
Thank you. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Just a few points that I would like to make. The joint appendix on page 11 is where the issue of waiver was addressed. In the middle of that page, the judge says, thank you. Let me just confirm both sides did waive the lesser included offenses that were raised by the evidence. And I think it's an interesting choice of language because he's not saying the instructions on the lesser included offenses. And I think that gets back to the point why this is called an all or nothing decision. In other words, both sides are saying we would rather decide the issue on the greater offense, however it comes out, and walk away either for the accused with an acquittal or for the government with no conviction.
But the judge refers to instructions in the previous sentence.
Well, right, I know.
This is a little bit highly word-smithing nature of...
I'm using that language only to make the bigger point of the all or nothing.
Well, and he also says that were presented. The lesser included offense that was presented.
Right.
Right. In other words, it was presented to the trier of fact. Yeah. And 59 says, does it not, that you can affirm a lesser included offense, and our gloss on it says, as long as the theory was presented to the trier of fact, which it was here.
Right. But that's why I want to sort of shift a little bit and say, it seems to me that when you're talking about government waiver, when you're talking about government waiver in this instance, they would never, on appeal, say it's an error because this should have been instructed on. See, I understand with defense and the argument they're making because that's what the cases address. Defense, you can't raise this on appeal because you waived it. What does a government waiver mean then? Because a government would never raise on appeal that there was an error because the instruction was not given. So it must mean something. And the only way that it would have any meaning is if an appellate court, a court of criminal appeals, said, because the government waived this issue, And the lower court did not address this point. As I recall reading the opinion, the lower court did not note or address or comment on the fact that the government waived this.
Counsel, which element of the lesser-included offense was the jury not instructed on?
They were not given any instruction on the lesser-included offense.
Which element of the lesser-included? I'm not asking you whether the lesser-included offense was instructed on. I'm asking a different question, which is, based on the instructions that were given, right, which element of the LIO was not presented to the members?
The bodily harm. I think, as I recall, it was the bodily harm aspect of it. So my argument is that it is an abuse of discretion for a court of criminal appeals to affirm a lesser-included offense where the government waived an instruction on that lesser-included offense. And maybe that's a better way to put my argument, is that, because I'm not going to deny that as you read the language of Article 59, that they're given the power. But I am going to argue that it's an abuse of that power for them to do so in a case where the government has said, we want it all or we want nothing. Why should they give the government something when the government in trial said, we want nothing if we don't get their conviction on the level of offense? And it is, as I think it is, a discretionary thing for the appellate court. I don't think they're required to affirm a lesser included. I think it's a discretionary matter. So and I've been in enough trials to know that the government doesn't always waive an instruction on the lesser-included offense. In fact, most of the times I've been in court, they argue for the instruction on the lesser-included offense. And I've had judges go against them and say, well, I'm going to accept the defense waiver. So to the extent that the appellate court or this court has addressed waiver in the context of the defense waiving an instruction on a lesser-included offense, they basically said, hey, as long as you can show on the record that it's an affirmative waiver, it's knowing, and this is what they're asking for, and they're taking an all-or-nothing approach, that's okay. It means you, defense, can't raise it on appeal. But that doesn't mean that we don't have any similar language for a government waiver, where the government has affirmatively said on the record, we'll waive it. And so it is in that, and perhaps some... This is obviously not an issue that arises everywhere in the military justice system, but I think that to the extent that this court speaks on that issue, the way the court can speak is to say, in the instance where the government waives it, where the government says we want all or nothing, then it would be an abuse of discretion for the court to...
So it's
in the context of this case.
Your position that if the defense waives a lesser-included instruction, and the Court of Criminal Appeals finds on appeal that the greater offense is not met factually or legally, what happens then?
I'm trying to think of if that has been addressed that way, and I don't know that.
Well, I thought of that when you said the
right
question doesn't go to the power of the Court of Criminal Appeals or says that it's in their discretion. But I wonder whether it is in their discretion under Article 66. That is, if all that's left is a lesser-included offense, why aren't they required then to affirm a lesser-included offense, even if the defense waived that at trial?
Why aren't they required?
Right.
And I'm not sure I'm tracking in the sense
that... You're saying the government should be treated like the defense. Well, let's say the defense waives the lesser-included instruction, and now you're on appeal, and the Court of Criminal Appeals says there's insufficient evidence, either factually or legally, to affirm the greater offense. Why is the court precluded from affirming a lesser-included at that point?
I don't know that they are. But I'm not saying that they should be treated the same.
Okay.
I'm not clear that that's not my argument. You can't treat them the same. And the reason you can't treat them the same is because the government can't raise on appeal it was error not to give this instruction on the lesser-included offense. So as we all know, the law doesn't always have a level playing field in that sense. And so what I'm saying is the only way an appellate court can effectuate a waiver by the government. Otherwise, the government waiver is meaningless. It has no meaning if an appellate court can say, well, we're going to do this, even though you waived it on appeal, and you said you were not effectively seeking a conviction for a lesser included offense. You took an all-or-nothing approach, just like the defense did.
So your position is that a government waiver, although it does not deprive the CCA of its statutory power to affirm,
right,
will constitute such an affirmance and abuse of discretion.
Right. And again, there's no case law on this point, so it's one of those things where I think this court is certainly riding on a clean slate. But given the unique power of the government and the power of prosecutorial discretion, it seems to me it would be an exceedingly rare circumstance where the appellate court would want to exercise its discretion in that way, i.e. finding a lesser-included offense where the government set on the record. We don't want a conviction on the lesser-included offense. And to me, that's what a government waiver should be read as inferring or applying. We want a conviction on the very offense, and if we can't have that, we're okay. We're okay with not having a conviction on the lesser-included offense. And what's wrong with asking the Court of Criminal Appeals to respect that? So, let me see if I had any points I wanted to make. No, I have no other points to make unless there are any questions.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 5 minutes before 10 o'clock.
Court stands in recess until 9:55.